Hello, and welcome to the Grant Street Experience. I am your host, Grant Irvin, Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Pittsburgh. I'm here today with my co-host, Rebecca Kiernan. Rebecca, how are you doing?
Hey, good morning.
And also colleague Shelly Danko Plus Day.
The plus is silent.
The plus is silent. The food policy guru for the City of Pittsburgh. Shelly, welcome to the Grant Street Experience.
Thanks, Grant. Thanks, Rebecca.
It's good to see you. So we're broadcasting from a variety of different places here. The audience kind of knows my attic and Rebecca's kitchen. Shelly, where are you coming from today?
I am. Are we talking neighborhood or like I'm in the city of Pittsburgh? Obviously, I'm in the Highland Park neighborhood, and this is my living room. With some of my art collection here, a tiny little Salvador Dali there.
Interesting.
Dog, I can't remember the dog's name, I'm sorry, but he's from Braddock, and that's a local photographer. And then up here you've got our, there's some interesting metal things and some skulls.
Very good.
That's just very a sampling good. Of what you could find in my home.
Exactly. That's great. Where'd you get the Salvador Dali from?
It was actually in an antique store over on the south side many, many years ago, probably 20 years ago.
Interesting. Well, thanks for joining us today. Food has been a hot topic during COVID-19, and we wanted to take a moment or a few moments on our show here to learn a little bit more about kind of the Pittsburgh food system and some of the challenges that we're facing with regards to both food distribution and food access across the city that's become all too prevalent both before COVID-19, but has really, I think, during the COVID crisis become a very visible kind of impact or issue that we've seen here in Pittsburgh. But maybe to get started, Shelly, if you could give folks a little bit about kind of background or about yourself, kind of how you came to food policy and how you came to work with the City of Pittsburgh and some of the work that you do here.
Okay, well, I guess my urban ag background goes all the way back to my days as a kid. My grandma grew a garden. She would always grow a ton of tomatoes and can them. And then we would have macaroni and tomatoes. That was my favorite lunch. I would put way too much butter and way too much salt in it for her liking, but it's still my favorite thing with way too much butter, way too much salt. And I remember eating scallions, like pulling them right out of the dirt and eating them that my dad grew. So there's that background. But then I kind of lost it for a while and then re-entered it back in 2004. I got laid off from a job and I had to look at my budget and figure out what I was going to do in the meantime while I found a job. And I realized that most of my budget was spent on food. And so I thought, well, why would I work for minimum wage to then spend all that money on food? So why don't I just work for food? So I got a job at a farm, Mildred's Daughters Urban Farm, and I did farm work for in exchange for food. So it was my first barter gig. And then I got a job with Grow Pittsburgh. I was the program manager for the Edible Schoolyard and established the Edible Schoolyards at both Faison and Dilworth elementary schools. And then when Chatham came out with their food studies program in 2009, it just spoke to me. So it was like everything that had been accumulating in my life up to that point, just seemed like, yeah, this is all the things that I'm into. So, went there, learned a lot, and got my master's degree in food studies, which is basically food systems. My focus was on markets and marketing. Mm-hmm. And so my thesis was on the East Liberty Farmers Market Cooperative, or the Farmers Market Cooperative of East Liberty, which is over by the Home Depot on Sheridan. It's been there since 1942, and it's still there and bustling every Saturday from 5 a.m. to noon, with local farmers, some anchor farmers that started there. So anyway, when I graduated from there, I did a few things. And then when the mayor, I did some consulting and some other odd jobs. And I did some cooking at home for people, which was interesting, and grocery shopping and like meal advising and prep and stuff. And so just, you know, trying to make ends meet because the master's in food studies doesn't really guarantee you a job. Anyway, in 2014, the mayor got elected and wanted to have somebody work on urban agriculture and food policy. So I ended up getting a job in city planning and doing that that task, I guess, through city planning. So I had never worked for the government before, and I had to figure out city planning and what I could do around the food system from that angle. Mm-hmm. So looked at the food system, and of course, you know, planning is land use. Right. So urban agriculture was easy. Plus, we had had this urban ag code, zoning code for chickens and bees since 2011, and it wasn't really working because we only had 13 permits out there, and we had a chicken coop tour that had 22 coops on it. So we knew there was some disconnect there. So we rewrote that, and it took about a year. Government mm-hmm. is very slow. And so it wasn't until July of 2015 that we ended up passing the zoning code that allowed chickens, ducks, bees, and two miniature goats by an over-the-counter permit. So you didn't need to go through the planning commission and get a variance, or the zoning board and get a variance. You could just get a permit over the counter. And it reduced the cost from $340 to $70.
Wow.
And now, breaking news, I didn't even know this. When this whole COVID thing came down, I was on vacation, as you both know. And I came
great,
back.
Great time to be on vacation.
It was a nice transition into working from home forever, or however long it ends up being. But people were asking me, because of course everybody's like panicking that now is the time to be sustainable, self-sustainable, and be able to grow your own food and raise your own food. And everyone wanted chickens. So I'm getting all these messages saying, how do I get a permit? How do I get a permit? I'm like, okay, I know this. So I contact zoning because everything's online now. I was like, where's the link for the chicken permit? And they're like, you don't need a permit for chickens. And I was like, what? That's what I wanted back in 2011, but I digress. So yeah, you don't need a permit for
what? You don't need an occupancy permit for your coop anymore?
Nothing.
What? I got busted for that.
I know.
That's good to know, Rebecca. So tell me about the urban ag code though, Shelley, if you dive a little bit deeper into it. So what can, you know, a person wants to raise chickens in their backyards or bees or goats, like what is kind of the process for them to do that?
Bees are different, obviously, than chickens. It seems like they're smaller and less of a nuisance, but there is a problem with being in their, it's called a flyway. So the bees leave their hive, and it takes them about 6 to 10 feet to get over your head, essentially. Mm-hmm. So you have to have that space that's not facing your neighbor's pool, that the bees can fly away. We've actually had that scenario happen in the city. So you want to make sure that you have the bees, the entrance of the hive facing away, and you have enough space so that they can get above people's heads before they're intersecting with where people are.
So bees need a runway, basically. Like
essentially, yeah. Yeah. And if you have like enough space, you don't have to build anything. Mm-hmm. But the language in the zoning code is very complicated.
So effectively, one of the things that you do is to help people navigate that process.
Yes. I find it just as confusing as they do. So it works out really well.
It's a new discovery process every time you go through it.
It really is.
Now, Rebecca, you have chickens too, right?
I do have chickens, and my chickens have an occupancy permit.
That's leading by example, Rebecca. That's what we like to see.
Cheers to that.
What is do you have chickens, Shelley?
Yes, I do.
You do. So what's tell us, both of you, I guess, tell us about raising chickens in the city. What goes into it? I mean, like the process, the start to finish, how do you kind of get the ball rolling, Rebecca?
Well, you need a coop first. They need somewhere to live. So I think that that's probably, I mean, Shelley, correct me if I'm wrong. I think that's probably step number one. Otherwise, I mean, they kind of, they ate all the weeds in the yard. I feed them all my food scraps, so we don't really have any food waste. And then, you know, I feed them every day with some feed that I get from a local greenhouse.
Water is important.
Yeah, water is important, but otherwise the eggs are just flowing.
Yeah.
So now how many chickens do each of you have, I guess?
Five.
I have four.
Is there a limit or?
Five is the limit.
Five
is the limit. 2,000 square feet, yeah.
Now, what is the yield in terms of like the number of eggs, I guess, that you get from like how many eggs a week?
A chicken, when it's prime laying, it'll lay an egg every 25 hours.
Okay. Wow.
How many are you getting, Rebecca?
I mean, it's depending on the type. You could get like egg layer chickens or meat focused chickens if you wanted to do that. Or then there's like the ornamental chickens.
Okay.
Pretty cool. You know, the ones with like the fluffy heads. But I just have some Tractor Supply chickens. And they're, I think we're on year four. And I get about two or three a day. Usually three.
Two or three eggs a day.
Yeah.
With four chickens.
Yeah. Pretty good. Pot Pie has not been producing like the others. She's like the freeloader.
The freeloader. What, now you name your chickens, right?
Yeah.
What are the names?
Mine are Pot Pie, Patty, Finger, and Roberta. But three of them are the same, and I have a hard time telling them apart. Oh, so apart. Pot Pie is the only one.
Patty, Finger, and Roberta.
And, and that's Patty, P-A-D-D-I-E, I guess, or
Chicken Patty.
Chicken Patty, Chicken Finger. Chicken Roberta? How's Roberta come into the mix?
She's kind of the outlier. Yeah.
And what about you, Shelly? Do your chickens have names?
They do, because people ask me all the time. So there's Sapphire, there's Steel, there's Amber, there's Comet, and there's Buffy.
Okay.
I am thinking more in terms of like, I do have some, I had like a Sapphire Gem that the chickens I got last year are kind of like more interesting breeds, but also they're more anxious. So every chicken has a kind of personality, and some chickens are more, okay with being confined, mm-hmm. and other chickens need to explore or they go crazy and start pecking their feathers out. And I think I have some anxious chickens right now. So I'm thinking about going back to just like some Leghorns, some real basic breeds, because my purpose for having chickens isn't for the novelty of it or the different, you know, it's so, what am I talking about? There's so many designer chickens out there now, the ones with the hats and the pants and the shoes, or, you know, they have the big fluffy feet.
Where does one get a chicken?
Sorry?
Where does one get a chicken?
There's a lot of places online you could order them. They actually ship them through the mail.
Really?
Yep.
I got mine at Tractor Supply, thinking that I would probably go through a couple of phases of chickens because, you know, things get them, you know, down here in the run. I think we have foxes and raccoons and stuff, but okay. 4 years later, I still have the same starter chickens that we bought, but I got them from Tractor Supply.
Where's the nearest Tractor Supply at?
We got it up in Erie.
Up in Erie, okay.
There's one in Natrona Heights, or Natrona, I guess.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
But you can get county fairs too if you want a real fancy chicken. Crawford County Fair has a good poultry barn.
Good poultry farm. That's interesting. So Shelly, do you see a lot of folks starting because of both like the code updates, you know, the urban ag code? I mean, how have things kind of proliferated in terms of urban agriculture here in the city? It seems as if there's kind of a growth in momentum that is, you know, more and more people are getting chickens in their backyard, or kind of the local growing movement. I don't know if you could kind of talk a little bit about some reflections that you've seen in terms of the growth of urban agriculture in the city.
Well, I think the sort of homesteading and, you know, farmers markets were kind of the first part of that in cities. And we, I guess our farmers markets started in like the 80s, 90s. And then it's just been kind of slowly increasing. And then, like I said, Chatham's Food Studies program was speaking to all of those interests that were coming up around the country. And so chickens just sort of fell right into that. And it was great when we didn't have a code. It was, I remember I emailed the mayor's office back in 2006 and they sent me the code for dogs and cats and said, this will work for your chickens. I still have that email. It's really funny. Anyway, but I think like now, so everybody's been kind of thinking in terms of sustaining themselves and being more food self-sustaining around food and growing their own food and canning and all of that. And the chickens, I think people kind of, maybe they shied away from chickens a little bit more because it is sort of an outside thing and you got to build a coop. Like you need to make sure that your coop has all sides solid so that things can't get in. Mm-hmm. Fencing won't protect your chickens. You need to have solid walls for them to sleep at night. Mm-hmm. But now with this COVID, people really are, I mean, eggs, I don't know if you noticed, but eggs at the farmer's market, at least, were going for $7 a dozen.
Wow.
$7. I know. So they just went through the roof. So we were just like secretly like, oh, we have eggs.
Yeah.
Over here with our eggs.
Yeah.
And we would give half a dozen to friends, but like half a dozen, not a dozen.
Not a dozen.
But yeah, I mean, it probably costs that to like on the feed that I feed them, but they also give me the compost for my garden. So my tomatoes are growing in the chicken manure and doing amazing. And then they eat my food scraps. So I don't have that going to the landfill. Like Rebecca was saying, that's a huge benefit to having chickens. So I think, but the dilemma that I'm having is that people want these designer chickens or they'll get them with, they'll get the insects. You can get them just female chickens. They will test them and make sure they're only female chickens. But people end up with roosters and they're like, oh, this poor rooster, what am I going to do with it? Don't get a rooster. Because right. Nobody wants a rooster and they can be violent. And I've got scars, puncture wounds from a rooster. I accidentally had once because I got Penn State extension and they didn't have them sexed. So I accidentally brought home a rooster. His name was Scrappy. And I don't know what happened to him. He escaped. but I think that's the thing that
Popeye? Is that what happened or
No, he really escaped. I was on vacation and my neighbor thought he knew how to handle chickens better than I did and it got away and we never saw him again.
Is there something that's more popular? Is it, I mean, you have chickens, ducks, bees, and goats. Is there one that you see more of in terms of people raising?
I think beekeeping is a very serious and time-consuming and somewhat expensive hobby. So, but you do see that a lot. People... I think that would be in competition with chickens, and chickens are a little less costly to set up. I would say you can do it on a thin budget, and they're pretty easy to take care of. But it's a daily thing. Like with bees, it's not a daily responsibility, but there is a responsibility there. With chickens, it's a daily responsibility, twice a day. But it's easier than a dog or a cat, and I think it's more beneficial than a cat. Even though cats are pretty easy, you still have to pick up its manure. Well, you pick up the chicken's manure and then you put it in your garden. So, and then the other thing that comes out of its butt, you get to eat. So it's all good.
Hey, Shelly, why goats and not sheep?
You know, goats were the one thing that a lot of other cities had done. I don't know, we were looking at a lot of things. We were looking at ruminants, and calling it ruminants in the code, which is so government. And I'm glad we changed to just goats instead of ruminants. I don't know. It got to the point where we were debating things so much that we just decided, like, let's just put in too many goats and see how it goes. Because we thought it was going to be nixed by council or something. And who knew what was going to happen? Because in 2011, when the legislation passed the first time, there was huge uproar, like people with signs like the bees are going to kill you. They're, you know, the mayor wants killer bees. And it was terrible. And the chickens, they're going to peck your eyes out. They're going to stink up the neighborhood. It's going to be terrible. The noise, you know, everybody had these ideas. So then by 2015, when we passed the new legislation there, like, we were gearing up. We had everybody lined, like, in at the defense and ready to go. And there was not one little peep. Like, nobody was upset about it. They're like, yeah, chickens, whatever.
What led to the change in public opinion?
I think people just got used to it. And it was one of the biggest lessons that I think I learned from government, is that sometimes you have to put something out there that's not great. It just puts it out there. It's messy and it's
conversation.
And yeah. And then people get used to it. And then, you know, when you do change it, like, now, I mean, nobody even knows that you don't need a permit anymore. That's huge. It wasn't even newsworthy. It wasn't even worth them telling me, which I think is really funny, because I helped to write the, anyway.
Is it education and awareness where people, you know, like your neighbor might have chickens, or your neighbor might be a beekeeper. So people are becoming more familiar and, as a result, more comfortable with the concepts.
Or they just don't care. Maybe they're like, oh, world's gone to hell. What am I going to do?
I mean, Rebecca, like with your neighborhood, I guess, like, are there others that have chickens in the run, or like?
I don't know if they have geese.
Chickens in the run. I love that.
There's some, there's some other ones down the block. There's also somebody that keeps bees down here too.
Okay.
But we also live underneath the parkway. So, I mean, you can't really hear them.
You can't hear them. Kind of muted. But I guess, like, the other thing though you see with this is that there's communities that are being formed, right? Where, like, Berg's Bees or there's a group of folks that are raising chickens that have started to come together to, like, share information with one another. I mean, those things are starting to proliferate, right, Shelley?
Well, actually, that started back in 2011 when they were writing the original Urban Ag Code, and when it passed, and it was so unattainable for a lot of people because of the price tag and the time frame and all the paperwork that was necessary. So there was an organization that came together called the Pittsburgh Pro Poultry People, or P4.
Okay, yeah. I got it.
You see where this is going.
The original P4.
Got a P4 too. Okay. So in 2011, the P4 started, and they had the Chicks in the Hood Coop Tour.
Right.
And that went on for several years. And I think we had one last year. I wasn't on the tour. I was on a couple of the tours in the very beginning. But yeah, so they did a lot of outreach. They were, like, at the convention center, at the,
The Home and Garden Show?
Home and Garden Show, yes. We were on KDKA once and telling people about chickens. So they were the go-to entity for anybody who wanted to learn about chickens. So municipalities would call them up and they'd take some chickens out there and teach people about handling chickens and mm-hmm. care of chickens. And so they did a really good job of advocating for chicken ownership and chicken raising. And they managed to get the code changed in quite a few places. And then finally in Pittsburgh, we changed it and added the goats, which is totally, like, you know, curveball, which is fun. But they're still sort of going. They're not really needed in the city of Pittsburgh anymore, obviously, but they still do education and outreach stuff. Although their P4 Google searches aren't the same anymore since the mayor came out with his P4.
Yeah, it's understandable. You've also done a lot of work with the Adopt-A-Lot program, and that has become another kind of critical tool for urban agriculture in the city, right? In terms of, if you could maybe share with folks about some of the organizations that you were working with that are using the Adopt-A-Lot program for an agricultural purpose, and maybe some of their stories, if you could share a little bit about that.
Okay, well, the Adopt-A-Lot program, for anyone who doesn't know, is the very first time in the history of the city of Pittsburgh. It's a way for people to access legally city-owned land for food, flower, or rain gardens. And we have about 150 lots that have been adopted out, and 40, I think it adds up to like 45 projects, something like that. And many of them are food gardens. So obviously with my interest in urban agriculture and food policy, that part was really the part that I wanted to work on, and improving the landscape for people who wanted to grow food in the city of Pittsburgh. So working with bugs, they adopted maybe
you can explain bugs a little bit.
Bugs, yeah, Bugs is a really great organization. It's the Black Urban Gardeners and Farmers of Pittsburgh. It's a national organization. We have the Pittsburgh chapter here, obviously, and they are a really great organization that grows food and does work in the community and teaches about growing food, and they're really awesome. So they have 6 or 8 lots on one site in Homewood, and then they got a second site across the street from that, and they've got an apiary there. They've got a hoop house. So this was the thing. We didn't have any of these things allowed on city land, and it was, I think everyone was kind of So the organizations that were trying to do these things were sort of fatalistic about it, like, oh, the zoning code won't let us do that. And I was like, well, that's crap. Let's make it happen. So we, through the Adopt-A-Lot program, it takes, government is very complicated, and it takes a long time to sort of sort through why something can't happen. And I used to say things like, why can't we just blah? And then I realized that there's a lot of reasons why we can't just anything in government. It's really, really complicated.
That extends beyond government too, but but I know what you mean.
And I guess anything with the multiple, you know, hundreds of years of layers of legislation and rules that they've put on there, because there's always a really good reason, and maybe a couple good reasons. And so working through those reasons and figuring out, like, we can't do it like this, we can do it like this, and so what about this? And anyway, so through the Adopt-A-Lot program, we get people access to city-owned lots for food, flower, rain gardens. And now we've got, you could put a hoop house on it because it's a temporary structure.
Maybe explain what hoop house is for folks.
A hoop house is, thanks, Grant, for keeping me on task. Hoop house is an unheated greenhouse that extends the growing season, both in the spring and in the fall, to where you could get almost like 10 or 11 months of growing out of our Pittsburgh years. So that's really, really beneficial to farmers, especially farmers who want to sell their products. It helps to have a longer growing season. And so Bugs was the first one to apply and go through the whole process, because it did take time to get a hoop house on their site, because it wasn't in, we had our commission in the city of Pittsburgh that approves everything that is on city-owned lots, any visual things on city-owned lots. So a hoop house is a big visual thing. Right. So we had to take the hoop house plans through Art Commission to get that approved to be built on city-owned land. So that got approved, and that was really huge to have that be the first one of its kind. So that sort of paved the way for other ones. We've had a few others subsequently come through and be part of the Adopt-A-Lot projects.
That's great. That's so great.
Little things like that, and trying to, you know, navigate all the new stuff that's happening. And this is all new. It takes a lot of time.
Just like what we've seen with kind of the, you know, the goats and chickens. I mean, same thing. Have you seen a growth in organizations like Bugs and others that are, you know, trying to develop kind of these urban agricultural installations in the last couple of years?
Yeah. And I'm not sure if it's because they've started coming into the city, or because they heard that, I think a lot of them that they were growing in the peri-urban areas, pardon me, like Tiny Seed Farm is one of them that adopted some land up in, Lincoln Lemington. Uh-huh. And they're doing a farm up there. But they heard about the Adopt-A-Lot program and thought, well, let's give this a shot.
And it brings an opportunity for people to grow food closer to where they live, right?
And where they sell.
Right.
Pittsburgh is the largest metropolitan area in the largest municipality in Allegheny County, of 128 municipalities. So this is really a lot of people's main sales point.
The the growth in kind of that is, I think, been really amazing, where people are starting to make kind of that connection with where their food comes from. And you've been a part of this too with farmers markets as well. What's that, the network look like, in terms of, I'm just thinking of, you've been involved with like the Bloomfield market, and you mentioned the food studies program at Chatham you're involved in, and you did the research around the East Liberty market. Where is food coming from, in terms of like the local farms, and what are some of the products that they're bringing to market here from southwestern Pennsylvania?
All over southwestern Pennsylvania, the farms are everywhere from like Fayette County, Somerset County. We've got a couple from Ohio, up north in Butler County. So I would say from within, probably like farmers wouldn't drive more than like 80 to 100 miles to get to market, if that. It's usually closer than that. And what sort of products? You mean like this time of year?
Just in general, I mean, what are Pennsylvania farmers bringing to a farmer's market? Like, what is the typical, whether it's like the types of produce or dairy, or what are some of those things that people are growing and bringing into the city?
Well, obviously lots of vegetables, and right now it's garlic scapes are the in season right now. So if you love your garlic, get some garlic scapes, make some pesto, just fry it up. It's delicious. Or I should say saute it up. Don't deep fry it. I guess that's pretty good. let's see. One of the things so lots of vegetables, obviously we grow. I haven't seen a lot of like milk, but I have seen a lot of cheese being brought to market. You'll find some cut flowers, which are always nice. And meat. Meat was really, during this weird time, this COVID time, what are we calling this time? This great pause.
Pandemic, call it.
This global pandemic time, meat, you know, we've all heard about the meat packaging companies, meat processing companies, factories shutting down because there's so many people with the COVID there, that our local meat producers have just been like, their sales have been going up so much to an overwhelming point.
Wow.
So it's good, but they're having to like recalibrate really quick. And I think another really interesting thing that's been happening at farmers markets is most of them have pivoted and figured out a way to take credit cards and payment on either like PayPal or Venmo or one of those services.
Okay.
And that's been pretty interesting too. And you could pay for stuff ahead of time. That's not food related, but it's commerce related. It makes it really easy for them to keep track of stuff too.
Well, and it's important too. I mean, Rebecca, you've seen this. I mean, in terms of the loss of the consumer practices have changed, right? Where, you know, we've had a commercial market that existed in terms of restaurants and, you know, kind of traditional grocery stores and things like that, that market basically disappeared. And everybody is in kind of the at-home market. So we've seen like the loss of product and material in like the dairy industry or others. You know, I mean, how has that shifted? I mean, what are some of the things you guys have seen there in terms of practices that have been changed because of the pandemic that, you know, are going to alter our food system going forward?
I mean, I think anecdotally, it seems like more people are purchasing CSAs, community supported agriculture boxes. I don't know that that's true. And I don't know if anybody's actually been studying it, but it seems like people are looking for more local sources. I was going to ask Shelley, are you seeing anything in terms of like the hyper local? So like, you know, we do have some of these farms that have hoop houses and are growing on adopt a lot lots. Are they able to sell any of their produce locally?
They are, yeah. I guess I can only talk about Bugs. They've been growing some greens in the hoop house, and they sold that at the farmer's market. I think Grow Pittsburgh has some, and there was a farmer's market in Homewood that I didn't make it to on Saturday. And apparently it was all the local entities selling their products. So yeah, I know it's definitely happening.
You can grow and sell from a city vacant lot, from an adopt a lot.
You can with a market stand lease. Yep.
Okay.
I mean, how do we get more of that, I guess? I mean, just the hyper-local movement in general. I mean, because we've seen, like, some of the benefits just with this study that, Shelley, we did with Carnegie Mellon and the folks at Tepper School about, you know, the climate benefits of reducing your food footprint in terms of the reduction of transportation emissions, you know, getting food from farm to market. Like, there's huge benefits to local economies, you know, connecting the farmer with kind of the local buyer, but also kind of reducing kind of the transportation costs. I mean, what are some ways in which we can do this, like Rebecca, to your point, like more hyper local growing and production and connecting with people?
Yeah, well, I just want to point out, Grant, that yeah, true, the transportation cost of food contributes to the carbon footprint, but actually the production of the food is huge. The fertilizer and the pesticides,
Carbon-based, I think would be the, but yeah, yeah, like the phosphorus and the nitrogen that goes into a lot of the fertilizer requires petroleum products. It's true.
Yeah. So that's the bigger part of it. And then also when you're talking about the meat industry, everyone wants to villainize poor cows. It's not their fault. If they were allowed to roam around and poop and fart where they want to, they'd be fine. But their manure is taken from their small confined spaces and put into a manure lagoon that continues to bubble up cow farts essentially for, you know, weeks or months after the cows have passed and become on our, you know, steaks on our plate. So that's the biggest problem with the global food system. Mm. So having your product be more local, the farmers are more attentive to these things. They don't use those pesticides or those chemical fertilizers. And it's more of a full cycle sort of farm that we're dealing with here. So supporting those is beneficial like tenfold. It's not just like making a decision and buying organic at Whole Foods. It has much more of an impact on the economy to buy local products. So did that answer your question?
It does. I mean, but it also starts to get into some of the work that you've done. And I wanted to make sure we touch on this about the issues of food insecurity. And I was wondering if you could share with folks some of the work that you and Chris and our team have helped put together with that's identifying kind of food insecurity and what that challenge is. So maybe if you can define food insecurity first, but I think let's also loop back into kind of this local production because it's about connecting people with a food source, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Local food is, I think a lot of people mistake local food for more expensive food because there are like some of the boutique farms, you know, get certified organic and they sell to restaurants to really make their money. That's a high-end product. They have customers that will pay the money. But there are a lot of farms that are just farms growing food. They've been doing it for years and they're less expensive than even a grocery store. So you could get really good food for good prices when you buy local food. The trend of
food insecurity.
Sorry, totally losing track. I haven't had all my coffee this morning yet. So, food insecurity is not a funny topic, though. Here in the city of Pittsburgh, we have over 63,000 people who don't have enough food to eat. And food insecurity is the lack of access to adequate amounts of healthy food to lead an active life. And 63,000 of our fellow Pittsburghers don't have that. And so it's for various reasons. It's not just that there's not a grocery store in their neighborhood. I think a lot of people think that's the solution to a food desert, like put a grocery store in. But it's a lot of other things. It includes like not having enough money to buy food. Or if you do have the money and the access to the food, you can find it. Do you know what to do with it? Do people know what to do with it? We've had generations of people without fresh food access. generations. They've lost that knowledge. Maybe they don't have clean water to be able to wash the produce. Maybe they don't have a pan or a stove to cook on. Maybe they don't have a refrigerator for the produce to not go bad quickly. So there are all those reasons. And then our unstable food system, as we just saw in the last 4 months. So all those things add up to food insecurity. And with the work that we've done, we mapped out all these different factors. And you can read that in the Feed Pittsburgh report. And we looked at, like, food insecurity is over 21% in the city of Pittsburgh as an average. If you look at some areas, it's much higher than that. And so we have,
to be clear, that's 21% of the population is food insecure.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. 21% of the population. So 1 in 5 people is food insecure in the city of Pittsburgh. And in some areas it's even higher than that. So we wanted to find out where those most affected areas are, and then you use our resources to be able to help those particular areas. And we're calling them healthy food priority areas. And you may have heard that or seen that in a report from Baltimore. Yeah, we copy Baltimore because they did some great work. and
We won't tell.
What? They know.
Oh.
We totally know. They're like, you go for it. But they do some really great work with Johns Hopkins over there in Baltimore. And so some of their methodology was just really great. And I thought, we need to know this. We need to look at this and we need to do something about it. So that's the start of it, was the Feed Pittsburgh report. And hopefully by, like, looking at this, we're getting together a focus group right now of residents to talk about the problem and find the solution. So,
yeah, maybe dive into that. We got a few more minutes left, but maybe if you could share about kind of that engagement with the Watson Fellowship, right? About kind of what the fellows will be working on, and you know, basically kind of what they're going to be up to this summer.
Yeah, so the Watson Foundation was going to send us an intern this summer. They were going to pay this person to come from New York City and live here in Pittsburgh and work in sustainability and resilience doing food policy stuff. And then when everything shut down and nobody could leave New York, they decided to do more project work and do it in teams. So we ended up we're so fortunate. We have a team of 5, Ethan, Alyssa, Anna, and Yvonne.
Wow.
And Jackie is managing them. And they are going to be working on community outreach for us. We've convened a group of residents from 3 of the sort of cluster neighborhood areas, the Homewood neighborhoods, the Hill District neighborhoods, and the North Side, sort of Charles Street, Valley, Perry, South. And they're going to be interviewing these residents to find out how they are. They're all people who are working in the area of food access and helping people to be able to get enough food. And so they're going to, the fellows will be interviewing people and finding out what those solutions are, what the coping mechanisms are right now that communities are doing to deal with their level of food insecurity. And hopefully we'll then have, we'll compile a list of best practices around Pittsburgh, because every city is different. And what works in Baltimore, what works in Los Angeles might not work here in Pittsburgh. So, and I also believe that like the mayor has said this too, like the solutions are in the community. And we need to uncover them and raise them up. We need to lift them up and provide them the resources that they need so that they can make that a more complete solution.
Yeah, the call that we had the other night, I thought was just really, really great from the standpoint of, one, seeing kind of the students and their interest and just being really engaged and being thoughtful about the topic, but also like the community members. Just hearing their stories in terms of kind of their the work that they're doing on the ground in terms of kind of this urban agricultural, you know, effectively like what's a movement that is really starting to shape up, but also kind of the resourcefulness I think is really kind of a great thing to capture. Just in the last couple minutes here, just to maybe finish out the food insecurity topic. I mean, what are some of the things that you see as opportunities that we have to address that issue? I mean, are there like one or two things that are kind of top of mind for you in helping to effectively reduce this 1/5 of the population, to reduce that number or eradicate that number of food insecurity?
Well, I hate to disappoint you, Grant, but I don't have a solution. I have some, you know, there are some best practices that have happened around the country, yeah. Like, you know, developing a local food hub that helps to support all of the local growers to be able to distribute the product, and really that would provide food for people, that would provide education and job training and potentially jobs for people very, very locally. So having that be a citywide food hub kind of thing is a really great solution in my mind. But is that what the community wants? Is that what the community is ready for? Is that what the community thinks is the solution? And there are things, like I said, there are things that are happening now that we aren't privy to because they're happening on such a, you know, ground level. And that's what we're hoping to sort of uncover and find out. For example, I heard somebody was saying that their church had a farmer's market after services. That's where people go.
Yeah.
They're leaving. There's food. Excellent. So that sort of thing I hadn't thought of before. Maybe other communities hadn't thought of before. And that's a tool in the toolbox that we offer to people. And how do we support that effort? Well, maybe there's some sort of collective buying. If we need to buy from a local farm and have it shipped in, or if we need to buy from a distributor because it's winter and we can't get it from a local farm. So buying in bulk is always better, and to be able to have it delivered. You can't have small quantities delivered. That's why the healthy corner stores have such a problem carrying small quantities of produce, because it doesn't sell. They get stuck with it, and then they have to get more too much, mm-hmm. another shipment of too much. So if we can help to consolidate or somehow even making those connections and facilitating that interaction between the entities that want to do this, that could be something that the city can do.
So really helping with the distribution and kind of aggregation issues.
Yeah.
Just maybe to kind of finish up here, I guess, for both of you, what are, I got two questions here. One is, what are some good resources to share with folks in terms of either things that you're listening to or reading on the topic of food, and particularly in this space of like urban agriculture? I mean, are there things that you would recommend either Rebecca or Shelley?
Go ahead, Shelley.
Gosh, I'm trying to think. I've just been reading other things to sort of entertain my brain. and podcasts are now my favorite thing.
Do you have a food podcast that you'd recommend? This podcast, of course.
Of course, this podcast.
Shelley, you're starting a food podcast, aren't you?
Yeah.
You have your own. Yeah.
It's gotten a little paused, but it's on its way. There's a podcast called Food Actually by Tamara Adler, and she's fantastic. It explains the food system in like 12 episodes, almost as good as my years of food studies. It's fantastic. It's really great. Another thing that I'm reading right now is a book called So You Want to Talk About Race.
Okay.
And that's really great. I can't remember the author's name. Ijima Olo.
Okay.
I'm probably slaughtering the name. I'm sorry. But yeah, that's really a great book too.
Awesome. How about you, Rebecca?
I don't know. It's been a while since I've been perusing Netflix for food documentaries. I do have a really good book that's called The Resilient Farm and Homestead. And it goes into like permaculture design, so that you're, you know, putting the plants that need the most tending to closest to your house, And then you kind of progressively get like the perennials and the other things that don't really need to be watered, you know, further outside. So that book was pretty good, but
yeah.
Have you guys had
Fun book, sorry about this. It's called Hit by a Farm. I read that a long time ago. I just, for some reason, I was reminded of it. And it's about this guy who decides he wants to buy a farm, and he goes, maybe it's a woman. I can't remember now. I read it a long time ago. Anyway, but yeah, they go out and start to have a farm and the adventures of farming. And there's sheep there, Rebecca. So you'd like that?
Nice.
Sheep's awesome. In the story.
Well, good stuff.
Are you going to go out and get chickens now?
It has been a conversation in the urban household. Yeah.
I think Kyla and Marty could use some chickens.
I think, if the dog is a precursor, neither Isla or Marley would do a good job of taking care of them. So that would fall on probably my shoulders and Amy's shoulders. So if we're up for taking care of the chickens, we've talked about it. So it might happen. That's why I was asking the questions.
Can I make some pre-chicken recommendations, some thought processes?
Yeah.
Figure out what your goal is with having chickens. Is it to have a cute pet, or is it to be sustainable in your food system? Like if you want to, you know, if you're having them for food, that's a whole different thing than if you're having them for a pet.
Yeah, I'd be in it for the food, I think.
And then decide if a chicken gets sick, how much are you willing to spend to fix that chicken? Because a chicken costs like $250 for a new one, just saying.
For a new chicken.
Yeah.
Wow.
$2.50, like less than a fiver. So I always opt for the new chicken.
What's the cost?
Well, when you buy a peep, it does take 6 months before you get eggs, but they're like $250, like two for five.
That's really inexpensive. Hard. Yeah.
So when people go out and spend like $300 to have their chicken's crop drained and flushed, yeah. I'm just like, okay.
What does that do?
If you've got sour crop, like if a chicken gets a sour crop, then it's just like, it's essentially like, because they don't chew. So they have, you know this, Rebecca, but for the rest of everybody out there. So they get the food and the grit in their crop, and the crop sort of like smooshes it around and breaks it down, and then it goes through the digestive system. And so if that gets blocked or soured or whatever, and it can't process the food, then the chicken just dies.
All right, we're going way too deep here.
Okay, well, sorry.
So I just want to thank you, Shelley. Thank you, Rebecca. Covered a lot of ground today in terms of our urban agriculture system. A lot of good information on chickens and farmers markets and food insecurity. Shelley, thank you so much for the work that you do and helping to share with our audience both the challenges and the opportunities here in the urban food system. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Grant. Thanks for your tough questions. I hope I did you proud.
Yeah, you did. You did well. You did well.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks, Shelley. And thank you all for listening in. This is the episode of the Grant Street Experience. I'm your host, Grant Irvin. Thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.